Chapter 7. More Worlds. 1. A Symbiotic Race. On certain large planets, whose climates, owing to the proximity of a violent sun, were very much hotter than our tropics, we sometimes found an intelligent fish-like race. It was bewildering to us to discover that a submarine world could give rise to mentality of human rank, and to that drama of the spirit which we had now so often encountered. The very shallow and sun-drenched oceans of these great planets provided an immense diversity of habitats and a great wealth of living things. Green vegetation, which could be classified as tropical, subtropical, temperate, and arctic, basked on the bright ocean floors. There were submarine prairies and forests. In some regions, the giant weed stretched from the sea bottom to the waves. In these jungles, the blue and blinding light of the sun was reduced almost to darkness. Immense coral-like growths, honeycombed with passages and swarming with all manner of live things, lifted their spires and turrets to the surface. Innumerable kinds of fish-like creatures of all sizes, from sprat to whale, inhabited the many levels of the waters, some gliding on the bottom, some daring an occasional leap into the torrid air. In the deepest and darkest regions, hosts of sea monsters, eyeless or luminous, browsed on the ceaseless rain of corpses which sank from the upper levels. Over their deep world lay other worlds of increasing brightness and colour, where gaudy populations basked, browsed, stalked, or hunted with arrowy flight. Intelligence in these planets was generally achieved by some unimposing social creature, neither fish nor octopus nor crustacean, but something of all three. It would be equipped with manipulatory tentacles, keen eyes, and subtle brain. It would make nests of weed in the crevices of the coral, or build strongholds of coral masonry. In time would appear traps, weapons, tools, submarine agriculture, the blossoming of primitive art, the ritual of primitive religion. Then would follow the typical fluctuating advance of the spirit from barbarism to civilization. One of these submarine worlds was exceptionally interesting. Early in the life of our galaxy, when few of the stars had yet condensed from the giant to the solar type, when very few planetary births had yet occurred, a double star and a single star in a congested cluster did actually approach one another, reach fiery filaments towards one another, and spawn a planet brood. Of these worlds, one, an immense and very aqueous sphere, produced in time a dominant race which was not a single species, but an intimate symbiotic partnership of two very alien creatures. The one came of a fish-like stock, the other was in appearance something like a crustacean. In form, it was a sort of paddle-footed crab or marine spider. Unlike our crustaceans, it was covered not with a brittle carapace, but with a tough, pachydermatous hide. In maturity, this serviceable jerkin was more or less rigid, save at the joints, but in youth, it was very pliant to the still expanding brain. This creature lived on the coasts and in the coastal waters of the many islands of the planet. Both species were mentally of human rank, though each had specific temperament and ability. In primitive times, each had attained by its own route and in its own hemisphere of the great aqueous planet to what might be called the last stage of the subhuman mentality. The two species had then come into contact and had grappled desperately. Their battleground was the shallow coastal water. The crustaceans, though crudely amphibian, could not spend long under the sea. The fish could not emerge from it. The two races did not seriously compete with one another in economic life, for the fish were mainly vegetarian, the crustaceans mainly carnivorous, yet neither could tolerate the presence of the other. Both were sufficiently human to be aware of one another as rival aristocrats in a subhuman world, but neither was human enough to realize that for each race, the way of life lay in cooperation with the other. The fish-like creatures, which I shall call ichthyoids, had speed and range of travel. They had also the security of bulk. The crab-like or spider-like crustaceans, which I shall call arachnoids, had greater manual dexterity, and had also access to the dry land. Cooperation would have been very beneficial to both species, for one of the staple foods of the arachnoids was parasitic to the ichthyoids. In spite of the possibility of mutual aid, the two races strove to exterminate one another and almost succeeded. After an age of blind mutual slaughter, certain of the less pugnacious and more flexible varieties of the two species gradually discovered profit in fraternization with the enemy. This was the beginning of a very remarkable partnership. Soon the arachnoids took to riding on the backs of the swift ichthyoids, and thus gained access to more remote hunting grounds. As the epochs passed, the two species molded one another to form a well-integrated union. The little arachnoid, no bigger than a chimpanzee, rode in a snug hollow behind the great fish's skull, his back being streamlined with the contours of the larger creature. The tentacles of the ichthyoid were specialized for large-scale manipulation, those of the arachnoid for minute work. A biochemical interdependence also evolved. Through a membrane in the ichthyoid's pouch, an exchange of endocrine products took place. This mechanism enabled the arachnoid to become fully aquatic. So long as it had frequent contact with its host, it could stay underwater for any length of time and descend to any depth. A striking mental adaptation also occurred in the two species. The ichthyoids became on the whole more introvert, the arachnoids more extrovert. Up to puberty, the young of both species were free-living individuals. But as their symbiotic organization developed, each sought out a partner of the opposite species. The union which followed was lifelong, and was interrupted only by brief sexual matings. The symbiosis itself constituted a kind of contrapuntal sexuality, but a sexuality that was purely mental, since, of course, for copulation and reproduction, each individual had to seek out a partner belonging to his or her own species. We found, however, that even the symbiotic partnership consisted invariably of a male of one species and a female of the other. And the male, whichever his species, behaved with parental devotion to the young of his symbiotic partner. I have not space to describe the extraordinary mental reciprocity of these strange couples. I can only say that, though in sensory equipment and in temperament, the two species were very different, and though in abnormal cases tragic conflicts did occur, the ordinary partnership was at once more intimate than human marriage, and far more enlarging to the individual than any friendship between members of distinct human races. At certain stages of the growth of civilization, malicious minds had attempted to arouse widespread interspecific conflict, and had met with temporary success. But the trouble seldom went as deep even as our sex war, so necessary was each species to the other. Both had contributed equally to the culture of their world, though not equally at all times. In creative work of every kind, one of the partners provided most of the originality, the other most of the criticism and restraint. Work in which one partner was entirely passive was rare. Books, or rather scrolls, which were made from pulped seaweed, were nearly always signed by couples. On the whole, the arachnoid partners dominated in manual skill, experimental science, the plastic arts, and practical social organization. The ichthyoid partners excelled in theoretical work, in literary arts, in the surprisingly developed music of that submarine world, and in the more mystical kind of religion. This generalization, however, should not be interpreted very strictly. The symbiotic relationship seems to have given the dual race a far greater mental flexibility than ours, and a quicker aptitude for community. It passed rapidly through the phase of intertribal strife, during which the nomadic shoals of symbiotic couples harried one another like hosts of submarine cavalry. For the arachnoids, riding their ichthyoid mates, attacked the enemy with bone spears and swords, while their mounts wrestled with powerful tentacles. But the phase of tribal warfare was remarkably brief. when a settled mode of life was attained, along with submarine agriculture and coral-built cities, strife between leagues of cities was the exception, not the rule. Aided no doubt by its great mobility and ease of communication, the dual race soon built up a worldwide and unarmed federation of cities. We learned also with wonder that at the height of the pre-mechanical civilization of this planet, when in our worlds the cleavage into masters and economic slaves would already have become serious, the communal spirit of the city triumphed over all individualistic enterprise. Very soon this world became a tissue of interdependent but independent municipal communes. At this time it seemed that social strife had vanished forever. But the most serious crisis of the race was still to come. The submarine environment offered the symbiotic race no great possibilities of advancement. All sources of wealth had been tapped and regularized. Population was maintained at an optimum size for the joyful working of the world. The social order was satisfactory to all classes and seemed unlikely to change. Individual lives were full and varied. Culture, founded on a great tradition, was now concerned entirely with detailed exploration of the great fields of thought that had long ago been pioneered by the revered ancestors, under direct inspiration, it was said, of the symbiotic deity. Our friends in this submarine world, our mental hosts, looked back on this age from their own more turbulent epoch, sometimes with yearning, but often with horror. For in retrospect, it seemed to them to display the first faint signs of racial decay. So perfectly did the race fit its unchanging environment that intelligence and acuity were already ceasing to be precious and might soon begin to fade. But presently it appeared that fate had decreed otherwise. In a submarine world, the possibility of obtaining mechanical power was remote. But the arachnoids, it will be remembered, were able to live out of the water. In the epochs before the symbiosis, their ancestors had periodically emerged upon the islands for courtship, parenthood, and the pursuit of prey. Since those days, the air-breathing capacity had declined, but it had never been entirely lost. Every arachnoid still emerged for sexual mating and also for certain ritual gymnastic exercises. It was in this latter connection that the great discovery was made which changed the course of history. At a certain tournament, the friction of stone weapons clashing against one another produced sparks and fire among the sun-scorched grasses. In startlingly quick succession came smelting, the steam engine, the electric current. Power was obtained first from the combustion of a sort of peat formed on the coasts by congested marine vegetation, later from the constant and violent winds, later still from photochemical light traps which absorbed the sun's lavish radiation. These inventions were of course the work of arachnoids. The ichthyoids, though they still played a great part in the systematization of knowledge, were debarred from the great practical work of scientific experiment and mechanical invention above the seas. Soon the arachnoids were running electric cables from the island power stations to the submarine cities. In this work, at least, the ichthyoids could take part, but their part was necessarily subordinate. Not only in experience of electrical engineering, but also in native practical ability, they were eclipsed by their arachnoid partners. For a couple of centuries or more, the two species continued to cooperate, though with increasing strain. Artificial lighting, mechanical transport of goods on the ocean floor, and large-scale manufacture produced an immense increase in the amenities of life in the submarine cities. The islands were crowded with buildings devoted to science and industry. Physics, chemistry, and biology made great progress. Astronomers began to map the galaxy. They also discovered that a neighboring planet offered wonderful opportunities for settlement by arachnoids, who might, without great difficulty, it was hoped, be conditioned to the alien climate and to divorce from their symbiotic partners. The first attempts at rocket flight were leading to mingled tragedy and success. The Directorate of Extramarine Activities demanded a much increased arachnoid population. Inevitably there arose a conflict between the two species, and in the mind of every individual of either species. It was at the height of this conflict, and in the spiritual crisis in virtue of which these beings were accessible to us, in our novitiate stage, that we first entered this world. The ichthyoids had not yet succumbed biologically to their inferior position, but psychologically they were already showing signs of deep mental decay. A profound disheartenment and lassitude attacked them, like that which so often undermines our primitive races when they find themselves struggling in the flood of European civilization. But since in the case of the symbiotics, the relationship between the two races was extremely intimate, far more so than that between the most intimate human beings, the plight of the ichthyoids deeply affected the arachnoids. And in the minds of the ichthyoids, the triumph of their partners was for long a source of mingled distress and exultation. Every individual of both species was torn between conflicting motives. While every healthy arachnoid longed to take part in the adventurous new life, he or she longed also, through sheer affection and symbiotic entanglement, to assist his or her ichthyoid mate to have an equal share in that life. Further, all arachnoids were aware of subtle dependence on their mates, a dependence at once physiological and psychological. It was the ichthyoids who mostly contributed to the mental symbiosis, the power of self-knowledge and mutual insight, and the contemplation which is so necessary to keep action sweet and sane. That this was so was evident from the fact that already among the arachnoids internecine strife had appeared. Island tended to compete with island, and one great industrial organization with another. I could not help remarking that if this deep cleavage of interests had occurred on my own planet, say between our two sexes, the favored sex would have single-mindedly trampled the other into servitude. Such a victory on the part of the arachnoids did indeed nearly occur. More and more partnerships were dissolved, each member attempting by means of drugs to supply his or her system with the chemicals normally provided by the symbiosis. For mental dependence, however, there was no substitute, and the divorced partners were subject to serious mental disorders, either subtle or flagrant. Nevertheless, there grew up a large population capable of living after a fashion without the symbiotic intercourse. Strife now took a violent turn. The intransigence of both species attacked one another and stirred up trouble among the moderates. There followed a period of desperate and confused warfare. On each side, a small and hated minority advocated a modernized symbiosis, in which each species should be able to contribute to the common life even in a mechanized civilization. Many of these reformers were martyred for their faith. Victory would in the long run have gone to the arachnoids, for they controlled the sources of power. But it soon appeared that the attempt to break the symbiotic bond was not as successful as it had seemed. Even in actual warfare, commanders were unable to prevent widespread fraternization between the opposed forces. Members of dissolved partnerships would furtively meet to snatch a few hours or moments of each other's company. Widowed or deserted individuals of each species would timidly but hungrily venture towards the enemy's camps in search of new mates. Whole companies would surrender for the same purpose. The arachnoids suffered more from neuroses than from the weapons of the enemy. On the islands, moreover, civil wars and social revolutions made the manufacture of munitions almost impossible. The most resolute faction of the arachnoids now attempted to bring the struggle to an end by poisoning the ocean. The islands, in turn, were poisoned by the millions of decaying corpses that rose to the sea's surface and were cast up on the shores. Poison, plague, and above all neurosis, brought war to a standstill, civilization to ruin, and the two species almost to extinction. The deserted skyscrapers that crowded the islands began to crumble into heaps of wreckage. The submarine cities were invaded by the submarine jungle and by shark-like subhuman ichthyoids of many species. The delicate tissue of knowledge began to disintegrate into fragments of superstition. Now at last came the opportunity of those who advocated a modernized symbiosis. With difficulty, they had maintained a secret existence, and their individual partnerships in the more remote and inhospitable regions of the planet. They now came boldly forth to spread their gospel among the unhappy remnants of the world's population. There was a rage of interspecific mating and remating. Primitive submarine agriculture and hunting maintained the scattered people, while a few of the coral cities were cleared and rebuilt, and the instruments of a lean but hopeful civilization were refashioned. This was a temporary civilization, without mechanical power, but one which promised itself great adventures in the upper world as soon as it had established the basic principles of the reformed symbiosis. To us, it seemed that such an enterprise was doomed to failure. So clear was it that the future lay with a terrestrial rather than a marine creature. But we were mistaken. I must not tell in detail of the heroic struggle by which the race refashioned its symbiotic nature to suit the career that lay before it. The first stage was the reinstatement of power stations on the islands, and the careful reorganization of a purely submarine society equipped with power. But this reconstruction would have been useless had it not been accompanied by a very careful study of the physical and mental relations of the two species. The symbiosis had to be strengthened so that interspecific strife should in future be impossible. By means of chemical treatment in infancy, the two kinds of organism were made more interdependent and in partnership more hardy. By a special psychological ritual, a sort of mutual hypnosis, all newly joined partners were henceforth brought into indissoluble mental reciprocity. This interspecific communion, which every individual knew in immediate domestic experience, became in time the basic experience of all culture and religion. The symbiotic deity, which figured in all the primitive mythologies, was reinstated as a symbol of the dual personality of the universe, a dualism, it was said, of creativity and wisdom, unified as the divine spirit of love. The one reasonable goal of social life was affirmed to be the creation of a world of awakened, of sensitive, intelligent, and mutually understanding personalities, banded together for the common purpose of exploring the universe and developing the human spirit's manifold potentialities. Imperceptibly, the young were led to discover for themselves this goal. Gradually and very cautiously, all the industrial operations and scientific researches of an earlier age were repeated, but with a difference. Industry was subordinated to the conscious social goal. Science, formerly the slave of industry, became the free colleague of wisdom. Once more, the islands were crowded with buildings and with eager arachnoid workers. But all the shallow coastal waters were filled with a vast honeycomb of dwelling houses, where the symbiotic partners took rest and refreshment with their mates. In the ocean depths, the old cities were turned into schools, universities, museums, temples, palaces of art and of pleasure. There the young of both kinds grew up together. There the full-grown of both species met constantly for recreation and stimulation. There, while the arachnoids were busy on the islands, the ichthyoids performed their work of education and of refashioning the whole theoretical culture of the world. For it was known clearly by now that in this field their temperament and talents could make a vital contribution to the common life. Thus literature, philosophy, and non-scientific education were carried out chiefly in the ocean, while on the islands industry, scientific inquiry, and the plastic arts were more prominent. Perhaps in spite of the close union of each couple, this strange division of labour would have led in time to renewed conflict, had it not been for two new discoveries. One was the development of telepathy. Several centuries after the age of war, it was found possible to establish full telepathic intercourse between the two members of each couple. In time, This intercourse was extended to include the whole dual race. The first result of this change was a great increase in the facility of communication between individuals all over the world, and therewith a great increase in mutual understanding and in unity of social purpose. But before we lost touch with this rapidly advancing race, we had evidence of a much more far-reaching effect of universal telepathy. Sometimes, so we were told, telepathic communion of the whole race caused something like the fragmentary awakening of a communal world mind in which all individuals participated. The second great innovation of the race was due to genetic research. The arachnoids, who had to remain capable of active life on dry land and on a massive planet, could not achieve any great improvement in brain weight and complexity. But the ichthyoids, who were already large and were buoyed up by the water, were not subject to this limitation. After long and often disastrous experiment, a race of super-ichthyoids was produced. In time, the whole ichthyoid population came to consist of these creatures. Meanwhile, the arachnoids, who were by now exploring and colonizing other planets of their solar system, were genetically improved not in respect of general brain complexity, but in those special brain centers which afforded telepathic intercourse. Thus, in spite of their simpler brain structure, they were able to maintain full telepathic community even with their big-brained mates far away in the oceans of the mother planet. The simple brains and the complex brains formed now a single system, in which each unit, however simple its own contribution, was sensitive to the whole. It was at this point, when the original ichthyoid race had given place to the super-ichthyoids, that we finally lost touch. The experience of the dual race passed completely beyond our comprehension. At a much later stage of our adventure, we came upon them again, and on a higher plane of being. They were by then already engaged upon the vast common enterprise, which, as I shall tell, was undertaken by the Galactic Society of Worlds. At this time, the symbiotic race consisted of an immense host of arachnoid adventurers, scattered over many planets, and a company of some 50,000 million super-ichthyoids, living a life of natatory delight and intense mental activity in the ocean of their great native world. Even at this stage, physical contact between the symbiotic partners had to be maintained, though at long intervals. There was a constant stream of spaceships between the colonies and the mother world. The ichthyoids, together with their teeming colleagues on a score of planets, supported a racial mind. Though the threads of the common experience were spun by the whole symbiotic race, they were woven into a single web by the ichthyoids alone in their primeval oceanic home, to be shared by all members of both races. 2. Composite beings. Sometimes in the course of our adventure, we came upon worlds inhabited by intelligent beings whose developed personality was an expression not of the single individual organism, but of a group of organisms. In most cases, this state of affairs had arisen through the necessity of combining intelligence with lightness of the individual body. A large planet rather close to its sun, or swayed by a very large satellite, would be swept by great ocean tides. Vast areas of its surface would be periodically submerged and exposed. In such a world, flight was very desirable, but owing to the strength of gravitation, only a small creature, a relatively small mass of molecules, could fly. A brain large enough for complex human activity could not have been lifted. In such worlds, the organic basis of intelligence was often a swarm of avian creatures, no bigger than sparrows. A host of individual bodies were possessed together by a single individual mind of human rank. The body of this mind was multiple, but the mind itself was almost as firmly knit as the mind of a man. as flocks of dunlin or redshank stream and wheel and soar and quiver over our estuaries, so above the great tide-flooded cultivated regions of these worlds, the animated clouds of avians manoeuvred, each cloud a single centre of consciousness. Presently, like our own winged waders, the little avians would settle, the huge volume of the cloud shrinking to a mere film upon the ground, a sort of precipitate along the fringe of the receding tide. Life in these worlds was rhythmically divided by the tides. During the nocturnal tides, the bird clouds all slept on the waves. During the daytime tides, they indulged in aerial sports and religious exercises. But twice a day, when the land was dry, they cultivated the drenched ooze, or carried out in their cities of concrete cells all the operations of industry and culture. It was interesting to us to see how ingeniously, before the tide's return, all the instruments of civilization were sealed from the ravages of the water. We supposed at first that the mental unity of these little avians was telepathic, but in fact it was not. It was based on the unity of a complex electromagnetic field, in fact on radio waves, permeating the whole group. Radio, transmitted and received by every individual organism, corresponded to the chemical nerve current which maintains the unity of the human nervous system. Each brain reverberated with the ethereal rhythms of its environment, and each contributed its own peculiar theme to the complex pattern of the whole. So long as the flock was within a volume of about a cubic mile, the individuals were mentally unified, each serving as a specialized center in the common brain. But if some were separated from the flock, as sometimes happened in stormy weather, they lost mental contact and became separate minds of very low order. In fact, each degenerated for the time being into a very simple instinctive animal or a system of reflexes, set wholly for the task of restoring contact with the flock. It may easily be imagined that the mental life of these composite beings was very different from anything which we had yet encountered, different and yet the same. Like a man, the bird cloud was capable of anger and fear, hunger and sexual hunger, personal love and all the passions of the herd. But the medium of these experiences was so different from anything known to us that we found great difficulty in recognizing them. Sex, for instance, was very perplexing. Each cloud was bisexual, having some hundreds of specialized male and female avian units, indifferent to one another, but very responsive to the presence of other bird clouds. We found that in these strange multiple beings, the delight and shame of bodily contact were obtained not only through actual sexual union of the specialized sexual members, but with the most exquisite subtlety in the aerial interfusion of two flying clouds during the performance of courtship gymnastics in the air. More important for us than this superficial likeness to ourselves was an underlying parity of mental rank. Indeed, we should not have gained access to them at all had it not been for the essential similarity of their evolutionary stage with that which we knew so well in our own worlds. For each one of these mobile-minded clouds of little birds was in fact an individual approximately of our own spiritual order, indeed a very human thing torn between the beast and the angel, capable of ecstasies of love and hate towards other such bird clouds, capable of wisdom and folly, and the whole gamut of human passions from swinishness to ecstatic contemplation. Probing as best we could beyond the formal similarity of spirit, which gave us access to the bird clouds, we discovered painfully how to see with a million eyes at once, how to feel the texture of the atmosphere with a million wings. We learned to interpret the composite percepts of mudflats and marshes and great agricultural regions, irrigated twice daily by the tide. We admired the great tide-driven turbines and the system of electric transport of freight. We discovered that the forests of high concrete poles or minarets and platforms on stilts, which stood in the shallowest of the tidal areas, were nurseries where the young were tended till they could fly. Little by little we learned to understand something of the alien thought of these strange beings, which was in its detailed texture so different from our own, yet in general pattern and significance so similar. Time presses, and I must not try even to sketch the immense complexity of the most developed of these worlds. So much else has still to be told. I will say only that, since the individuality of these bird clouds was more precarious than human individuality, it was apt to be better understood and more justly valued. The constant danger of the bird clouds was physical and mental disintegration. Consequently, the ideal of the coherent self was very prominent in all their cultures. On the other hand, the danger that the self of the bird cloud would be psychically invaded and violated by its neighbours, much as one radio station may interfere with another, forced these beings to guard more carefully than ourselves against the temptations of the herd, against drowning the individual cloud self in the mob of clouds. But again, just because this danger was effectively guarded against, the ideal of the worldwide community developed without any life-and-death struggle with mystical tribalism, such as we know too well. Instead, the struggle was simply between individualism and the twin ideals of the world community and the world mind. At the time of our visit, worldwide conflict was already breaking out between the two parties in every region of the planet. The individualists were stronger in one hemisphere and were slaughtering all adherents of the world mind ideal and mustering their forces for attack on the other hemisphere. Here the party of the world mind dominated, not by weapons but by sheer radio bombardment, so to speak. The pattern of ethereal undulations issuing from the party imposed itself by sheer force on all recalcitrants. All rebels were either mentally disintegrated by radio bombardment or absorbed intact into the communal radio system. The war which ensued was to us astounding. The individualists used artillery and poison gas. The party of the world mind used these weapons far less than the radio, which they, but not their enemies, could operate with irresistible effect. So greatly was the radio system strengthened, and so adapted to the physiological receptivity of the avian units, that before the individualists had done serious harm, they found themselves engulfed, so to speak, in an overwhelming torrent of radio stimulation. Their individuality crumbled away. The avian units that made up their composite bodies were either destroyed, if they were specialized for war, or reorganized into new clouds, loyal to the world mind. Shortly after the defeat of the individualists, we lost touch with this race. The experience and the social problems of the young world mind were incomprehensible to us. Not till a much later stage of our adventure did we regain contact with it. Others of the world inhabited by races of bird clouds were less fortunate. Most, through one cause or another, came to grief. In many of them, the stresses of industrialism or of social unrest brought about a plague of insanity or disintegration of the individual into a swarm of mere reflex animals. These miserable little creatures, which had not the power of independent, intelligent behaviour, were slaughtered in myriads by natural forces and beasts of prey. Presently, the stage was clear for some worm or amoeba to reinaugurate the great adventure of biological evolution towards the human plane. In the course of our exploration, we came upon other types of composite individuals. For instance, we found that very large dry planets were sometimes inhabited by populations of insect-like creatures, each of whose swarms or nests was the multiple body of a single mind. These planets were so large that no mobile organism could be bigger than a beetle, no flying organism bigger than an ant. In the intelligent swarms that fulfilled the part of men in these worlds, the microscopic brains of the insect-like units were specialized for microscopic functions within the group, much as the members of an ant's nest are specialized for working, fighting, reproduction, and so on. all were mobile, but each class of the units fulfilled special neurological functions in the life of the whole. In fact, they acted as though they were special types of cells in a nervous system. In these worlds, as in the worlds of the bird clouds, we had to accustom ourselves to the unified awareness of a huge swarm of units. With innumerable hurrying feet, we crept along Lilliputian concrete passages. With innumerable manipulatory antennae, we took part in obscure industrial or agricultural operations, or in the navigation of toy ships on the canals and lakes of these flat worlds. Through innumerable many-faceted eyes, we surveyed the plains of moss-like vegetation, or studied the stars with minute telescopes and spectroscopes. So perfectly organized was the life of the minded swarm that all routine activities of industry and agriculture had become, from the point of view of the swarm's mind, unconscious, like the digestive processes of a human being. The little insectoid units themselves carried on these operations consciously, though without understanding their significance. But the mind of the swarm had lost the power of attending to them. Its concern was almost wholly with such activities as called for unified conscious control, in fact with practical and theoretical invention of all kinds, and with physical and mental exploration. At the time of our visit to the most striking of these insectoid worlds, the world population consisted of many great nations of swarms. Each individual swarm had its own nest, its Lilliputian city, an area of about an acre, in which the ground was honeycombed to a depth of 2 feet, with chambers and passages. The surrounding district was devoted to the cultivation of the moss-like food plants. As the swarm increased in size, colonies might be founded beyond the range of the physiological radio system of the parent swarm. Thus arose new group individuals. But neither in this race nor in the race of bird clouds was there anything corresponding to our successive generations of individual minds. Within the minded group, the insectoid units were ever dying off and giving place to fresh units, but the mind of the group was potentially immortal. The units succeeded one another, the group self persisted. Its memory reached back past countless generations of units, fading as it receded, and finally losing itself in that archaic time when the human was emerging from the subhuman. Thus, the civilized swarms had vague and fragmentary memories of every historical period. Civilization had turned the old disorderly warrens into carefully planned subterranean cities, had turned the old irrigation channels into a widespread mesh of waterways for the transport of freight from district to district, had introduced mechanical power based on the combustion of vegetable matter, had smelted metals from outcrops and alluvial deposits, had produced the extraordinary tissue of minute, almost microscopic machinery, which had so greatly improved the comfort and health of the more advanced regions, had produced also myriads of tiny vehicles corresponding to our tractors, trains, ships, had created class distinctions between those group individuals that remained primarily agricultural, those that were mainly industrial, and those that specialized in intelligent coordination of their country's activities. These last became in time the bureaucratic tyrants of the country. Owing to the great size of the planet and the extreme difficulty of long-distance travel by creatures so small as the insectoid units, civilizations had developed independently in a score of insulated regions. And when at last they came in contact, many of them were already highly industrialized and equipped with the most modern weapons. The reader may easily imagine what happened when races that were in most cases biologically of different species, and anyhow were completely alien in customs, thought, and ideals, suddenly found themselves in contact and in conflict. It would be wearisome to describe the insane warfare which ensued, but it is of interest to note that we, the telepathic visitors from regions remote in time and space, could communicate with these warring hosts more easily than one host could communicate with another. And through this power, we were actually able to play an important part in the history of this world. Indeed, it was probably through our mediation that these races were saved from mutual destruction. Taking up positions in key minds on each side of the conflict, we patiently induced in our hosts some insight into the mentality of the enemy. And since each of these races had already passed far beyond the level of sociality known on the Earth, since in relation to the life of his own race, a swarm mind was capable of true community, the realization of the enemy as being not monstrous but essentially humane was enough to annihilate the will to fight. The key minds on either side, enlightened by divine messengers, heroically preached peace, and though many of them were hastily martyred, their cause triumphed. The races made terms with each other, all save two formidable and culturally rather backward peoples. These we could not persuade, and as they were by now highly specialized for war, they were a very serious menace. They regarded the new spirit of peace as mere weakness on the part of the enemy, and they were determined to take advantage of it and to conquer the rest of that world. But now we witnessed a drama which to terrestrial man must surely seem incredible. It was possible in this world only because of the high degree of mental lucidity which had already been attained within the bounds of each race. The Pacific races had the courage to disarm. In the most spectacular and unmistakable manner, they destroyed their weapons and their munition factories. They took care, too, that these events should be witnessed by enemy swarms that had been taken prisoner. These captives they then freed, bidding them report their experiences to the enemy. In reply, the enemy invaded the nearest of the disarmed countries and set about ruthlessly imposing the military culture upon it by means of propaganda and persecution. But in spite of mass executions and mass torture, the upshot was not what was expected. For though the tyrant races were not appreciably more developed in sociality than Homo sapiens, the victims were far superior. Repression only strengthened the will for passive resistance. Little by little, the tyranny began to waver. Then suddenly it collapsed. The invaders withdrew, taking with them the infection of pacifism. In a surprisingly short time, that world became a federation, whose members were distinct species. With sadness I realized that on the Earth, though all civilized beings belong to one and the same biological species, such a happy issue of strife is impossible, simply because the capacity for community in the individual mind is still too weak. I wondered too whether the tyrant races of insectoids would have had greater success in imposing their culture on the invaded country if there had been a distinct generation of juvenile, malleable swarms for them to educate. When this insectoid world had passed through its crisis, it began to advance so rapidly in social structure and in development of the individual mind that we found increasing difficulty in maintaining contact. At last, we lost touch. But later, when we ourselves had advanced, we were to come upon this world again. Of the other insectoid worlds, I shall say nothing, for not one of them was destined to play an important part in the history of the galaxy. To complete the picture of the races in which the individual mind had not a single, physically continuous body, I must refer to a very different and even stranger kind. In this, the individual body is a cloud of ultra-microscopic, subvital units organized in a common radio system. Of this kind is the race which now inhabits our own planet Mars. As I have already in another book described these beings and the tragic relations which they will have with our own descendants in the remote future, I shall say no more of them here, save that we did not make contact with them till a much later stage of our adventure, when we had acquired the skill to reach out to beings alien to ourselves in spiritual condition. 3. Plant Men and Others. Before passing on to tell the story of our galaxy as a whole, so far as I can comprehend it, I must mention another and a very alien kind of world. Of this type, we found few examples, and few of these survived into the time when the galactic drama was at its height. But one at least had, or will have, a great influence on the growth of the spirit in that dramatic era. On certain small planets, drenched with light and heat from a near or a great sun, evolution took a very different course from that with which we are familiar. The vegetable and animal functions were not separated into distinct organic types. Every organism was at once animal and vegetable. In such worlds, the higher organisms were something like gigantic and mobile herbs. But the violent flood of solar radiation rendered the tempo of their life much more rapid than that of our plants. To say that they looked like herbs is perhaps misleading, for they looked equally like animals. They had a definite number of limbs and a definite form of body, but all their skin was green or streaked with green, and they bore here or there, according to their species, great masses of foliage. Owing to the slight power of gravitation on these small planets, the plant animals often supported vast superstructures on very slender trunks or limbs. In general, those that were mobile were less generously equipped with leaves than those that were more or less sedentary. In these small hot worlds, the turbulent circulation of water and atmosphere caused rapid changes in the condition of the ground from day to day. Storm and flood made it very desirable for the organisms of these worlds to be able to move from place to place. Consequently, the early plants, which owing to the wealth of solar radiation, could easily store themselves with energy for a life of moderate muscular activity, developed powers of perception and locomotion. Vegetable eyes and ears, vegetable organs of taste, scent and touch, appeared on their stems or foliage. For locomotion, some of them simply withdrew their primitive roots from the ground and crept hither and thither with a kind of caterpillar action. Some spread their foliage and drifted on the wind. From these, in the course of ages, arose true flyers. Meanwhile, the pedestrian species turned some of their roots into muscular legs, 4 or 6, or centripetal. The remaining roots were equipped with boring instruments, which on a new site could rapidly proliferate into the ground. Yet another method of combining locomotion and roots was perhaps more remarkable. The aerial portion of the organism would detach itself from its embedded roots and wander off by land or air to strike root afresh in virgin soil. When the second site was exhausted, the creature would either go off in search of a third and so on, or return to its original bed, which by now might have recovered fertility. There, it would attach itself once more to its old dormant roots and wake them into new activity. Many species, of course, developed predatory habits and special organs of offense, such as muscular boughs as strong as pythons for constriction, or talons, horns, and formidable serrated pincers. In these carnivorous creatures, the spread of foliage was greatly reduced, and all the leaves could be tucked snugly away along the back. In the most specialized beasts of prey, the foliage was atrophied and had only decorative value. It was surprising to see how the environment imposed on these alien creatures forms suggestive of our tigers and wolves. And it was interesting, too, to note how excessive specialization and excessive adaptation to offense or defense ruined species after species. And how, when at length human intelligence appeared, it was achieved by an unimposing and inoffensive creature whose sole gifts were intelligence and sensibility towards the material world and towards its fellows. Before describing the fluorescence of humanity in this kind of world, I must mention one grave problem which faces the evolving life of all small planets, often at an early stage. This problem we had already come across on the other Earth. Owing to the weakness of gravitation and the disturbing heat of the sun, the molecules of the atmosphere very easily escape into space. Most small worlds, of course, lose all their air and water long before life can reach the human stage, sometimes even before it can establish itself at all. Others, less small, may be thoroughly equipped with atmosphere in their early phases, but at a much later date, owing to the slow but steady contraction of their orbits, they may become so heated that they can no longer hold down the furiously agitated molecules of their atmosphere. On some of these planets, a great population of living forms develops in early eons, only to be parched and suffocated out of existence through the long-drawn denudation and desiccation of the planet. But in more favorable cases, life is able to adapt itself progressively to the increasingly severe conditions. In some worlds, for instance, a biological mechanism appeared by which the remaining atmosphere was imprisoned within a powerful electromagnetic field generated by the world's living population. In others, the need of atmosphere was done away with altogether. Photosynthesis and the whole metabolism of life were carried on by means of liquids alone. The last dwindling gases were captured in solution, stored in huge tracts of spongy growths among the crowded roots, and covered with an impervious membrane. Both these natural biological methods occurred in one or other of the plant-animal worlds that reached the human level. I have space only to describe a single example, the most significant of these remarkable worlds. This was one in which all free atmosphere had been lost long before the appearance of intelligence. To enter this world and experience it through the alien senses and alien temperament of its natives was an adventure in some ways more bewildering than any of our earlier explorations. Owing to the complete absence of atmosphere, the sky, even in full sunlight, was black with the blackness of interstellar space, and the stars blazed. Owing to the weakness of gravitation and the absence of the molding action of air and water and frost on the planet's shrinking and wrinkled surface, the landscape was a mass of fold mountains, primeval and extinct volcanoes, congealed floods and humps of lava, and craters left by the impact of giant meteors. None of these features had ever been much smoothed by atmospheric and glacial influences. Further, the ever-changing stresses of the planet's crust had shattered many of the mountains into the fantastic forms of icebergs. On our own Earth, where gravity, that tireless hound, pulls down its quarry with so much greater strength, these slender, top-heavy crags and pinnacles could never have stood. Owing to the absence of atmosphere, the exposed surfaces of the rock were blindingly illuminated. The crevices and all the shadows were black as night. Many of the valleys had been turned into reservoirs, seemingly of milk, for the surfaces of these lakes were covered with a deep layer of a white glutinous substance to prevent loss by evaporation. Round about clustered the roots of the strange people of this world, like tree stumps where a forest has been felled and cleared. Each stump was sealed with the white glue. Every stretch of soil was in use, and we learned that though some of this soil was the natural result of past ages of action by air and water, most was artificial. It had been manufactured by great mining and pulverizing processes. In primitive times, and indeed throughout all pre-human evolution, the competitive struggle for a share of the rare soil of this world of rock had been one of the main spurs to intelligence. The mobile plant men themselves were to be seen by day clustered in the valleys, their foliage spread to the sun. Only by night did we observe them in action, moving over the bare rock, or busy with machines and other artificial objects, instruments of their civilization. There were no buildings, no roofed, weatherproof enclosures, for there was no weather. But the plateaus and terraces of the rock were crowded with all manner of artifacts unintelligible to us. The typical plant man was an erect organism like ourselves. On his head, he bore a vast crest of green plumes, which could be either folded together in the form of a huge, tight cos lettuce, or spread out to catch the light. Three many-faceted eyes looked out from under the crest. Beneath these were three arm-like manipulatory limbs, green and serpentine, branching at their extremities. The slender trunk, pliable, encased in hard rings, which slid into one another as the body bowed, was divided into three legs for locomotion. Two of the 3 feet were also mouths, which could either draw sap from the root or devour foreign matter. The third was an organ of excretion. The precious excrement was never wasted, but passed through a special junction between the third foot and the root. The feet contained taste organs, and also ears. Since there was no air, sound was not propagated above ground. By day, the life of these strange beings was mainly vegetable. By night, animal. Every morning, after the long and frigid night, the whole population swarmed to its rooty dormitories. Each individual sought out his own root, fixed himself to it, and stood throughout the torrid day with leaves outspread. Till sunset he slept, not in a dreamless sleep, but in a sort of trance, the meditative and mystical quality of which was to prove in future ages a well of peace for many worlds. While he slept, the currents of sap hastened up and down his trunk, carrying chemicals between roots and leaves, flooding him with a concentrated supply of oxygen, removing the products of past catabolism. When the sun had disappeared once more behind the crags, displaying for a moment a wisp of fiery prominences, he would wake, fold up his leaves, close the passages to his roots, detach himself, and go about the business of civilized life. Night in this world was brighter than moonlight with us, for the stars were unobscured, and several great clusters hung in the night sky. Artificial light, however, was used for delicate operations. Its chief disadvantage was that it tended to send the worker to sleep. I must not try even to sketch the rich and alien social life of these beings. I will only say that here, as elsewhere, we found all the cultural themes known on Earth, but that in this world of mobile plants, all was transposed into a strange key, a perplexing mode. Here, as elsewhere, we found a population of individuals deeply concerned with the task of keeping themselves and their society in being. Here we found self-regard, hate, love, the passions of the mob, intellectual curiosity, and so on. And here, as in all the other worlds that we had thus far visited, we found a race in the throes of the great spiritual crisis, which was the crisis familiar to us in our own worlds, and formed the channel by which we had telepathic access to other worlds. But here the crisis had assumed a style different from any that we had yet encountered. We had, in fact, begun to extend our powers of imaginative exploration. Leaving all else unnoticed, I must try to describe this crisis, for it is significant for the understanding of matters which reached far beyond this little world. We did not begin to have insight into the drama of this race till we had learned to appreciate the mental aspect of its dual, animal-vegetable nature. Briefly, the mentality of the plant men, in every age, was an expression of the varying tension between the two sides of their nature, between the active, assertive, objectively inquisitive, and morally positive animal nature, and the passive, subjectively contemplative, and devoutly acquiescent vegetable nature. It was, of course, through animal prowess and practical human intelligence that the species had long ago come to dominate its world. But at all times, this practical will had been tempered and enriched by a kind of experience which among men is very rare. Every day, throughout the ages, these beings had surrendered their feverish animal nature not merely to unconscious or dream-racked sleep, such as animals know, but to the special kind of awareness which, we learned, belongs to plants. Spreading their leaves, they had absorbed directly the essential elixir of life, which animals receive only at second hand in the mangled flesh of their prey. Thus they seemingly maintained immediate physical contact with the source of all cosmical being. And this state, though physical, was also in some sense spiritual. It had a far-reaching effect on all their conduct. If theological language were acceptable, it might well be called a spiritual contact with God. During the busy night time, they went about their affairs as insulated individuals, having no present immediate experience of their underlying unity. But normally they were always preserved from the worst excesses of individualism by memory of their daytime life. It took us long to understand that their peculiar daytime state did not consist simply in being united as a group mind, whether of tribe or race. Theirs was not the condition of the avian units in the bird cloud, nor yet of the telepathically constituted world minds, which, as we were later to discover, had a very great part to play in galactic history. The plant man did not, in his daytime life, come into possession of the percepts and thoughts of his fellow plant men, and thereby waken into a more comprehensive and discriminate awareness of the environment and of the multiple body of the race. On the contrary, he became completely unresponsive to all objective conditions, save the flood of sunlight drenching his spread leaves. And this experience afforded him an enduring ecstasy, whose quality was almost sexual, an ecstasy in which subject and object seemed to become identical, an ecstasy of subjective union with the obscure source of all finite being. In this state, the plant man could meditate upon his active nighttime life, and could become aware, far more clearly than by day, of the intricacies of his own motives. In this daytime mode, he passed no moral judgments on himself or others. He mentally reviewed every kind of human contact with detached, contemplative joy, as a factor in the universe. But when night came again, bringing the active nocturnal mood, the calm daytime insight into himself and others was lit with a fire of moral praise and censure. Now, throughout the career of this race, there had been a certain tension between the two basic impulses of its nature. All its finest cultural achievements had been made in times when both had been vigorous and neither predominant. But as in so many other worlds, the development of natural science and the production of mechanical power from tropical sunlight caused grave mental confusion. The manufacture of innumerable aids to comfort and luxury, the spread of electric railways over the whole world, the development of radio communication, the study of astronomy and mechanistic biochemistry, the urgent demands of war and social revolution, all these influences strengthened the active mentality and weakened the contemplative. The climax came when it was found possible to do away with the daytime sleep altogether. The products of artificial photosynthesis could be rapidly injected into the living body every morning, so that the plant man could spend practically the whole day in active work. Very soon the roots of the peoples were being dug up and used as raw material in manufacture. They were no longer needed for their natural purpose. I must not spend time in describing the hideous plight into which this world now fell. Seemingly, artificial photosynthesis, though it could keep the body vigorous, failed to produce some essential vitamin of the spirit. A disease of robotism, of purely mechanical living, spread throughout the population. There was, of course, a fever of industrial activity. The plant men careered round their planet in all kinds of mechanically propelled vehicles, decorated themselves with the latest synthetic products, tapped the central volcanic heat for power, expended great ingenuity in destroying one another, and in a thousand other feverish pursuits pushed on in search of a bliss which ever eluded them. After untold distresses, they began to realize that their whole way of life was alien to their essential plant nature. Leaders and prophets dared to inveigh against mechanization and against the prevalent intellectualistic scientific culture, and against artificial photosynthesis. By now, nearly all the roots of the race had been destroyed. But presently, biological science was turned to the task of generating from the few remaining specimens new roots for all. Little by little, the whole population was able to return to natural photosynthesis. The industrial life of the world vanished like frost in sunlight. In returning to the old, alternating life of animal and vegetable, The plant men, jaded and deranged by the long fever of industrialism, found in their calm daytime experience an overwhelming joy. The misery of their recent life intensified by contrast the ecstasy of the vegetal experience. The intellectual acuity that their brightest minds had acquired in scientific analysis, combined with the special quality of their revived plant life, to give their whole experience a new lucidity. For a brief period, they reached a plane of spiritual lucidity, which was to be an example and a treasure for the future eons of the galaxy. But even the most spiritual life has its temptations. The extravagant fever of industrialism and intellectualism had so subtly poisoned the plant men that when at last they rebelled against it, they swung too far, falling into the snare of a vegetal life as one-sided as the old animal life had been. Little by little, they gave less and less energy and time to animal pursuits, until at last their nights as well as their days were spent wholly as trees, and the active, exploring, manipulating animal intelligence died in them forever. For a while, the race lived on, in an increasingly vague and confused ecstasy of passive union with the universal source of being. So well established and automatic was the age-old biological mechanism for preserving the planet's vital gases in solution that it continued long to function without attention. But industrialism had increased the world population beyond the limits within which the small supply of water and gases could easily fulfill its function. The circulation of material was dangerously rapid. In time, the mechanism was overstrained. Leakages began to appear, and no one repaired them. Little by little, the precious water and other volatile substances escaped from the planet. Little by little, the reservoirs ran dry. The spongy roots were parched, the leaves withered. One by one, the blissful and no longer human inhabitants of that world passed from ecstasy to sickness, despondency, uncomprehending bewilderment, and on to death. But as I shall tell, their achievement was not without effect on the life of our galaxy. Vegetable humanities, if I may so call them, proved to be rather uncommon occurrences. Some of them inhabited worlds of a very curious kind, which I have not yet mentioned. As is well known, a small planet close to its sun tends, through the sun's tidal action upon it, to lose its rotation. Its days become longer and longer, till at last it presents one face constantly towards its luminary. Not a few planets of this type, up and down the galaxy, were inhabited, and several of them by vegetable humanities. All these non-diurnal worlds were very inhospitable to life, for one hemisphere was always extravagantly hot, the other extravagantly cold. The illuminate face might reach the temperature of molten lead. On the dark face, however, no substances could retain the liquid state, for the temperature would remain but a degree or two above absolute zero. Between the two hemispheres there would lie a narrow belt, or rather a mere ribbon, which might be called temperate. Here, the immense and incendiary sun was always partly hidden by the horizon. Along the cooler side of this ribbon, hidden from the murderous rays of the sun's actual disk, but illuminated by his corona and warmed by the conduction of heat from the sunward ground, life was not invariably impossible. Inhabited worlds of this kind had always reached a fairly high stage of biological evolution, long before they had lost their diurnal rotation. As the day lengthened, life was forced to adapt itself to more extreme temperatures of day and night. The poles of these planets, if not too much inclined towards the ecliptic, remained at a fairly constant temperature, and were therefore citadels whence the living forms ventured into less hospitable regions. Many species managed to spread towards the equator by the simple method of burying themselves and hibernating through the day and the night, emerging only for dawn and sunset to lead a furiously active life. As the day lengthened into months, some species, adapted for swift locomotion, simply trekked round the planet, following the sunset and the dawn. Strange it was to see the equatorial and most agile of these species sweeping over the plains in the level sunlight, Their legs were often as tall and slender as a ship's masts. Now and then they would swerve with long necks extended to snatch some scurrying creature or pluck some bunch of foliage. Such constant and rapid migration would have been impossible in worlds less rich in solar energy. Human intelligence seems never to have been attained in any of these worlds, unless it had been attained already before night and day became excessively long, and the difference of these temperatures excessively great. In worlds where plant men or other creatures had achieved civilization, and science before rotation had become seriously retarded, great efforts were made to cope with the increasing harshness of the environment. Sometimes civilization merely retreated to the poles, abandoning the rest of the planet. Sometimes subterranean settlements were established in other regions, the inhabitants issuing only a dawn and sunset to cultivate the land. Sometimes a system of railways along the parallels of latitude carried a migratory population from one agricultural center to another following the twilight. Finally, however, when rotation had been entirely lost, a settled civilization would be crowded along the whole length of the stationary girdle between night and day. By this time, if not before, the atmosphere would have been lost also. It can well be imagined that a race struggling to survive in these literally straitened circumstances would not be able to maintain any richness and delicacy of mental life.